Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I'm happy to announce an important legal case. I was in court just before Thanksgiving, testifying for a day and a half, not far from my office in Ithaca. This was in Syracuse, New York, and it was a malpractice case. A man committed suicide. He was a really marvelous individual, a beloved assistant principal and coach, basketball coach. His team had actually won the state finals at one point. A wonderful family, loving family. And he'd been put on Paxil for 10 years without seeing his doctor, who was a local family physician who had a reputation for being very good at treating, or at least he seemed to feel he had a reputation, and other doctors, that he had a reputation for taking care of psychiatric problems. And without seeing this man for 10 years, he continued him on his Paxil. When he ran into some problems, the man called him, and his wife called the doctor after 10 years, who was vacationing at the time, and had him on the phone without having seen him in 10 years, double his Paxil, and they had a good measure, some Zyprexa. Perhaps if he had had his medical notes with him, he would have seen that that dose of Paxil had originally caused this individual emotional problems, and he had cut back on it at the start. And that was the beginning of a month's downhill course. I testified that in several ways this physician had committed malpractice, and that eventually his death had been the product of this physician's malpractice and the psychiatric drugs that were given to him, including Paxil and then Effexor. I also testified that a hospital doctor who saw him during this month committed negligence. The jury agreed with me about both doctors committing negligence, but found that only the original doc, the one who hadn't seen him for 10 years and then doubled his Paxil on the phone and then virtually abandoned him when it turned out that this was not a good medication regimen, they found him to be not only neglectful, but that he had caused or contributed to the suicide. And the jury awarded a $1.5 million verdict. This is a big deal because it's very hard for people to accept that suicide isn't driven by one's own self, by one's own free will. It's hard for people to attribute self-destructive behavior to malpractice and to psychiatric drugs. And I thoroughly understand that. When I was younger, I actually came out and said I didn't think a drug could make anyone do anything they didn't want to do. But as I studied the science more and more and finally wrote my first medical book in 1983, by then it was becoming apparent to me that the evidence is overwhelming for psychiatric drugs driving people over the edge into violence and suicide. And of course, I presented a lot of cases and a lot of information in my book, Medication Madness. So this is an important step to win a case like this. And that it just makes me feel that times really are changing, that while psychiatry remains totally obstinate in its pursuit of drugging people, that the general public, lawyers, juries, and the people I talk to on the radio and at conferences are becoming increasingly aware that psychiatric drugs can do more harm than good. You can read about more of the details of the case, including the doctor's name, the lawyer's name, on my most recent blog on Huffington Post, which you can get to from Huffington Post or from my website, Bregan.com. Now, today, my guest. You know, I've mentioned to you that I've been traveling a lot lately. And last week, I interviewed a psychiatrist that I'd met at a conference, who's become a new friend. Well, today is yet another friend, and really someone I already feel is a dear friend, whom I met at a conference entitled Reclaiming Childhood, and it was sponsored by the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health. This is a very good conference held in Syracuse, New York. And at the conference, I met Bob Nickel. Bob's name is spelled N-I-K-K-E-L. I met Bob Nickel. I met his lovely wife, who is, I guess, CEO of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. Bob, like myself, very close to his partner in everything he does. We might end up talking a little bit about that before we're done. Now, Bob is going to tell you about the Foundations for Excellence in Mental Health. He's also executive director at Jefferson Behavioral Health, and he's an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry, public psychiatry training programs at Oregon. That's the Oregon Health and Sciences University. I mean, really, how can I be friends with such a person? That's going to be interesting to discuss. I mean, this man actually has establishment relationships and identity. Well, I'm going to let you figure all that out, but he is certainly one of the loveliest human beings I've met in a long, long, long time. I spent hours and hours with him just talking at the conference. Bob, hello.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, it's coming through loud and clear. I'm on the 10th floor of a building in downtown Portland, Oregon.
Oh, my gosh. Yes, you sound clear. Not loud, but clear. I think it'll be fine.
Okay.
How are you, my friend?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm enjoying running again. It was hard to run when I was on my travels. I had been in North Carolina after that, and then a trip to Philadelphia. So I've been out of my element, but I'm glad to be back home.
Well, good, 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 good. Bob, tell us a bit about, if you like, about the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. I view it as a very important step in psychiatric reform, and one that needs support from other folks.
Yes, we're relatively new as foundations go, and I'm told that it's a community foundation, which means it can have a whole variety of funding bases for it. I can tell you about that in a little bit. But we formed about a year and a half, 2 years ago. A number of us read Bob Whitaker's book, Anatomy of an Epidemic. And we simply couldn't just walk away from it and do nothing. Most of us had been involved in the mental health and addictions fields for 30, and in my case, almost 45 years. And this was a stunning book for some of us. So there were people in North Carolina and some people in Boston, and then a couple of us out in Oregon, and Bob Whitaker connected us all. And out of the discussions, we decided to form this foundation. Bob, you know, I think has reasonably, we're still in touch, but he's not involved with us directly. We still check in with him, of course, and like Peter, Bob has become good friends with us. But the foundation is the slogan that we're using is recovery, the new mainstream. We're really dedicated to the idea that these terms like SPMI, CMI, severe and persistent mental illness, chronic mental illnesses, they're all wrong. And if you look at the research, it clearly shows a very different picture that most people do recover, whether they take meds or not. In fact, people who don't take meds often frequently do as well or better than people who do take meds. So we're not anti-medication, but the term we often use is medication optimization. I can tell you that personally I'm very concerned about the level at which we've been using medications. I think we've come to rely on them far too much, and I think they've become far too much of the mental health system.
Bob, just go on and just talk some more about the foundation. I think I can help clarify what it means to be a community foundation, and that could be important for some of our listeners. My understanding is that as a community foundation, you can actually have other groups that want to become 501c3s, that want to become nonprofits under the federal rules. They can actually join you and gain that status through you, through your community, in a sense. So if you've got some really good ideas out there, and maybe you've got some funding or some hope for funding, and you want to set up a 501c3 that's reform-oriented, you could, instead of going through all the hoops yourself, you could work with Bob Nichols' group. Is that a correct analysis?
That would be very correct, yeah.
And groups are joining you, I gather.
Yes, we have some. Some of us attended the Philadelphia conference that Peter was very involved with, and in fact actually helped create the forerunner, the International Society for Ethical Psychiatry and Psychology. And we haven't announced it very formally yet, but they're very interested in setting up a fund under our umbrella foundation. So that's one example. Another example that I'll just tell about real quickly, one of the people in Oregon who has been a major influence for me and other people is Dr. Dean Brooks. Many people know Dr. Brooks because he allowed the film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to be filmed at his hospital, Oregon State Hospital. He was the superintendent there for 27 years. He's now 97 years old, and he's just created a new fund under the foundation called the Dorothea Dix Think Tank. His goal is to decriminalize, these are his words, decriminalize mental illness. So that's another example of the kind of fund that we're taking under us, and we're working with some people around the country who are involved with that. There's, as I said, a think tank, and there are about six or seven people, including Ellen Sachs at the University of Southern California, and others. So that's another example of the kind of fund that we're developing.
You need funding yourself, right?
Yeah. One of the things that when you're a new foundation, it takes a while to really get your funding base up and going. Frequently, people call us and they think we have tons of money. We have some, but it's limited, and we're trying to get enough to have an infrastructure so that we can actually build up enough funding so that we can be a source of funding. We're in a developmental phase, I would say. And as Peter has said, my wife is the CEO and president, Dr. Gina Nichol. And so she's working 7 days a week, trying to maintain contacts with people all over the country. In fact, all over the world. We just got a funding, a small amount of funding, but it came from Wales in the United Kingdom.
That sounds really, 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 really good. How did you, tell us a little bit about your history, how you got involved in what I would call psychiatric reform, and some of what you're doing separately from this foundation?
Yeah, Peter, give away my darkest secret, and that was that I was a state mental health commissioner here in Oregon for 6 years. That was an interesting experience, but let me tell you how I got to that. I call myself the accidental commissioner. I really didn't go into it with any intention. In fact, I never applied for it, interviewed, or wanted the job. I'll tell you the rest of the story in a little bit, maybe. But I got started in the mental health field in my childhood, in some sense, because my grandfather and an uncle had gotten very aware of the deplorable conditions in state hospitals during World War II. I'm a Mennonite by background, and so Mennonites are almost always conscientious objectors, pacifists. And during World War II, a lot of the young men went conscientious objector status, didn't go into the military, and instead many of them were sent around the country to state hospitals. There was a powerful book called The Shame of the States that was written shortly after. So they experienced what it was like to be in, frankly, pretty terrible conditions for people in state hospitals. I heard these stories when I was a little kid. when it came time for me to branch out into the world, I was also a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, and I decided to do alternative service, and I ended up going to work in one of the Mennonite psychiatric hospitals. There were about 7 hospitals that got started as a result of the young men coming out of World War II, and I went to work in one of them in Kansas as a psychiatric aide. I've looked at some of the things I wrote back then, and I was almost already then I was really choking at the way authoritarianism and hierarchies and control and power were being used in what I thought should have been an entirely different Mennonite-operated facility. So I guess in some ways my advocacy work started back in about 1969. I worked there for several years. I ended up eventually going to graduate school and getting a master's degree in social work at the University of Kansas. I moved back to the West Coast where I'd grown up, and the only job I could find was working as an alcohol and drug counselor at first. Boy, was I introduced to the concept of recovery there, and this was about 1978 by then. So that really set me, I think, on the right track. I've gotten clearer and clearer about it as I've gotten more experience, and I've met people like Peter and Bob Whitaker and many other people around the country. I then got into doing community mental health work. I let myself get kicked up and up and up in the hierarchical ladder, and as I mentioned, I ended up the state mental health commissioner. I eventually got fired, I think partly because I was an advocate and that was not what was wanted at the time. I said this in a conference in Philadelphia a couple weeks ago, and I got the strongest burst of applause I've ever had in my life for having gotten fired. And so that was kind of a unique and gratifying experience to have.
Were you able to accomplish anything working in the system? Because one of the things that I've said, and perhaps incorrectly, is that the moment a person becomes effective in a psychiatric system, they get fired.
Yes, and you and I have talked already a little bit about that, Peter, and can you really accomplish any good, or if you can, how long do you last? And I think there's really something to that issue. I do think you can get some things accomplished, but I know now that I've been out of the job for 3 years and I've been in other things, I feel much freer to talk and speak my own mind, and I think that's something you have to be careful about in bureaucratic positions. I'm not saying it can't be done, but I think you always run the risk that might lead to your exit door. But did we accomplish things? And first of all, I don't think any single person in the public system can really accomplish anything. It's all teamwork. But some of the things that we accomplished that I feel good about in Oregon was we got all of the kids out of the state hospital. We created other programs for them. I'm not sure that's the total final solution to it all, but, you know, for a kid or an adolescent to talk to their friends and say, yeah, I was in the state hospital, that's a pretty devastating kind of thing to have to tell people. And I think it affects people's self-identities as well. So that was one thing I would point to. Another thing that we were able to do was capitalize on an early psychosis project that had started in the Salem, Oregon area, and we were able to get $4.3 million out of one of the legislative sessions to expand that program. So it was based on something like the Open Dialogue model, the Patrick McGorry model out of Australia. And again, I'm not sure it's I'm entirely comfortable with everything that they do, but one of the important things that I see them having done is to tell young people and their families going through what appears to be a first psychotic episode that they can recover. I think the expectation that people can recover is a very powerful thing. So that instead of only having about 20% of people when they go through the usual and customary services, 20% ending up getting their schoolwork back together or getting a job, we've flipped those statistics around so that about 80% of the people, you know, fairly soon after they get out of the program are able to get back to, you know, work and school and having friends and, what do we say, a date on Saturday night. So those are a couple of things. Another thing that I should just mention is Dual Diagnosis Anonymous. And although I'm not a big fan of diagnostic issues, This was a program that started in Southern California, and people who had both a mental health challenge and alcohol and drug problems would often try to go to regular AA meetings and NA meetings, and they just weren't welcome there. So a colleague of mine, Corbett Monica, started Dual Diagnosis Anonymous. He walked into my office one day, told me what he had done, and I had about $50,000 I hadn't spent yet in my budget. I gave it to him, and I said, see what you can do. DDA, as we call it, is now, we have about 3,000, 4,000 people just in Oregon attending this. We're now in about 15 or 20 other states, and I just understand from Corbett that we opened our first DDA meeting in Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic. So it's getting out and around, and that was one of those things that I actually could take a fairly immediate step, because I did have access to some resources, and I found a program that I liked. I thought it was a good concept, and we went for it, and it's worked quite well. So those are some of the things that I could tell you about.
I'd like to hear more about both of the programs. Let's go back to the first of the two, which was a program aimed at young people that had an 80% return to their relatively normal lives. And how did that work? What was the therapeutic thrust of it?
Yeah, the name of it, it helps define it somewhat. It's what's called Early Assessment, Supports, and Treatment. They've now changed their name to ESA, Early Assessment Support Alliance. What they do is they have a good referral network developed, so that when a young person runs into difficulty in college or high school, or they're seeing their primary care doctor, sometimes, unfortunately, they get involved with juvenile justice or the adult world and criminal justice. But the idea is to get them into this program. It's an outpatient kind of program. They do a lot of education with families and the young person. They, as I said, one of the key educational pieces is to say, look, this is not a life sentence to you. You are not chronically mentally ill. You don't have a serious and persistent mental illness. We can work with you and your family to get through this really difficult time in your life. They're very cautious, particularly open dialogue, but they're very cautious about the use of medications. That's one thing that if I were to be involved now more directly, I would work with them more on reducing the use of medication even more. But that's, you know, that's often a transition that programs need to go through.
Bob, did they go into the home the way open dialogue does?
Yes, exactly. And I was going to tell you, I referred a family that I knew. Their son had been a really good student in high school. He'd played on the baseball team. He was I'd met him. I got to know him. He's really a great young man. Something changed for him, and he started, he was running around the West Coast in a pickup. And one day, in an apparent psychotic episode, he was almost ready to kill his father in the backyard with a shovel. I got him referred and the family to the program. He was so fearful and distrustful that he wouldn't even go into the outpatient office. The psychiatrist saw him out in a park and went and did the early assessment interview with him on a park bench. From there, they worked with the family, gave supports. I don't know that they ever used medication on him. He ended up being a nurse in one of the hospitals in Oregon. That's a complete turnaround from what it could have been had he actually harmed his father. He could have gone into the criminal justice system or the mental health forensic system, and he might have been there the rest of his life. So that was one really dramatic example. They don't require families to go into outpatient offices. If they want to, that's fine, but they're really flexible about how they do that piece of the work.
And this program survived your departure?
Yeah, actually, it really was something that was easier to sell, in a sense, to our legislature than to some other things. It was really pretty tangible, and the results were so outstanding that we were able to expand it in 2007, my last legislative session. And we have now about 60 to 70% of Oregon's families who are experiencing this able to get access to this ESA program. My goal is to get it to, for for Oregon to be the first state in the country to offer this to every single family and young person who's going through this difficult time in their lives.
That is really exciting. Does it have a wraparound aspect? I mean, are there services that these families are given in the way of direct financial help or babysitting help, respite to get away from the kids, or any of the other things we associate with a large intervention, or is this mostly a direct therapy intervention?
I think it's fair to say it's mostly a direct therapy intervention. If the person needs some supports, things like supported employment, supported education, supported housing, I'm not sure that they call them that, but those kind of wraparound services are indeed made available to the families. Often the families need so much support. They're so anxious, they're so fearful, as the young person is, that a lot of what's involved, in my view of this, is reassuring the family that we'll get through this. This isn't a life sentence. You know, we know how to do this, and having confidence that recovery is really the norm.
What a difference from what the current system is doing. It's going to be very good to see a follow-up on this. I hope maybe you or someone else will write it up and publish it that hasn't been done already. Because, I mean, these are where the solutions are. I think we know what is needed in terms of these interventions for young people, getting help for the whole family, working through the parents, not treating the child as having a disease, but having a family problem to be dealt with. We really do know. But these programs usually don't last very long, or they end up becoming psychiatrized and reverting back to the more traditional methods.
Yeah, exactly. Now, back to the foundation for just a minute. We're funding a couple of projects. One is an open dialogue project, and another one may become that, but the foundation is interested in funding creative, hopeful programs. So what I think the real challenge here is not to just have these as pilot projects here and there, but really to change the system and make this the standard of care for young people and their families going through this.
Where is your Open Dialogue? By the way, for people who don't know, Open Dialogue is a program that you can Google. It's developed in Finland and is a family intervention program that has been incredibly successful in getting young people through psychotic breaks without hospitalization, with minimal or no medication. They practically eradicated the concept of schizophrenia in the area that they're working in. It's very successful. And again, we kind of know what models work best. I'm talking with Bob Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L. He's a board member of the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. He's in Portland, Oregon. Is there if we're just going to go to break, but just before we go, is there a way people can easily get in touch with you?
Yeah, I think the easiest way is to contact us through the foundation. I'm also fine with giving out my personal email address, and, as long as I don't get over about 200 or 300 emails a day, which is what I got when I was a state mental health commissioner, I can probably handle it. So just the simplest way is Bob Nickel, B-O-B-N-I-K-K-E-L, @gmail.com. I can then connect you directly into the foundation because, as I said, I live with the person who's the president and CEO.
We're going to go to break now and bring on the music. And when we come back, I'd like you to talk also about this dual diagnosis program that's spreading around the world.
I'll be happy to do that.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin and my guest, Bob Nickel. Bob, we were talking about some of the programs you actually managed to get going in your 6-year stint as, God forbid, Commissioner of Mental Health of Oregon. And One of them was the stool diagnosis program. What was special about that? What's making it useful?
I think what it does is it gives people who don't always feel comfortable going to regular meetings, and sometimes the regular AA and NA meetings don't respond very well. If the person seems different, is talking differently, God forbid if they ever said that they were hearing voices, they're not real welcome. So that was really the experience that my friend and colleague Corbett Monica, the founder of DDA, had when he was in the Los Angeles area. In fact, the story he tells is he took a young man named Ruben, and after the session, he got a call from the leader of the AA group, and they said, "Don't ever bring him back." So instead of whining about it or trying to change the entire world of AA, he decided to start his own 12-step program. And so that's essentially how Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon got its start. Like I said, he hadn't really been able to get it off the ground very far. So we used some public funds to get it started. We now have three or four or five different funding sources. Some of them are public, some of them are other funding sources. But what the group really does is, if you've ever been to an AA or NA meeting, you know that they go around, they talk openly about their struggles, they talk about the successes they're having, things that help. It's really the mutual support, being with people who have been struggling with themselves, many of whom are in a much stronger phase of recovery, especially when a younger person comes into it for the first time. They really need those role models and mentoring. So I think it has many of the same dynamics going on that regular 12-step programs have. But it's really geared particularly to people who have struggled with mental health challenges and alcohol and drug issues. By the way, that's another area that I was involved with in the 1980s. I ran an NIMH project that worked with the same folks. And we were already then using the recovery concept as the end goal for where we hope people could get to. So what I saw with Dual Diagnosis Anonymous was really an extension of the kind of work that I'd done earlier, but something that would outlast public programs. And so that's if you want a description of it, Dr. Bob Drake from Dartmouth Psychiatric Research Center has been working with us to publicize it, and we published an article in Psychiatric Services about a year and a half ago. We're taking that research initiative a little bit further. We're working on another article now with Dartmouth, which will describe what it's like for someone actually experiencing the program. The first article was descriptive. The next one will be from the view of people who are participating, members of DDA, what's it like for them. And then finally, the third article we anticipate will be one which really looks at the outcomes and the kind of cost savings that it can mean. And if you're dealing in the public sphere, you have to at some point talk about the finances and the ways in which if you do this, you avoid costs over here.
I'm a big fan of 12-step programs. Excuse me. And actually, one of my patients started a psychiatric drug withdrawal or recovery 12-step program. Now, my understanding is this has to be pretty much separate from AA itself. I don't think that anything that's directly under the AA umbrella can take outside funds or promote itself. Are you familiar with that concept?
Yeah, I certainly am, and that's one respect in which this is different. So there's some similarities and there's some differences.
Can anyone set up a 12-step program, or does AA consider that a trademark?
You know, that's an answer or a question I don't have a good answer to. I think that's something that I'll look into. We haven't had any problems with AA or NA being concerned about the development of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous. So I would say that it hasn't been an issue, at least in this one project.
And how did somebody get a hold of this? Are you in the phone book in cities the way AA is?
We're more advertised through Internet. There's a site that people can look at if they want to see this. It's called DDA of Oregon, all one word, DDAofOregon.com, and it's .com, and I'm not sure why we got .com instead of .org, but that's what it is. And you can go to our website and you can see where different meetings are. And you can also email Corbett Monica through that process. And if you're in another state, which you probably are, we can get you in touch with those the meetings that are in each of the other states that we're involved with. I should say, too, that since I'm no longer a person who funds them, they asked me to be on their board of directors, and they asked me to be the treasurer of the board. So I just want to make that clear that I'm involved directly with the organization now that I'm not in a position to fund them anymore.
Well, I'm really, really excited about hearing about that. I would like to see the AA model extended virtually to all the stuff that we usually deal with in psychology and psychiatry, because it's just the fundamental good ethics, good community building, sound spiritual values, emphasis on taking responsibility for oneself, and then, of course, for helping one's fellow human beings through the fellowship. So I'm a very big fan of it, and I want to see it expand more and more. And I think the recovery aspect of it is important. It's so interesting that psychiatry has no recovery model at all. I'm sitting here listening to you and mulling on that a little more than I have in the past. You know, a psychiatric drug to get approved doesn't have to cure anybody. All it's got to do is show some statistical improvement in a few symptoms that usually don't bear a lot of relationship to the actual quality of life of the individual, just a few check-off symptoms, and it gets approved. It's got nothing to do with recovery. So when you're taking your psychiatric drug, there was not even an attempt to test to see if anybody, quote, recovered. So I think recovery is really foreign to the whole concept of the psychopharmaceutical industry, the FDA, the APA, and psychiatry in general. And that's a pretty astonishing realization.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the things I wanted to mention about why I think 12-step programs are successful are that they're grassroots. The mental health professionals and the addictions professionals didn't start these things. In fact, when I was, Dr. Drake is an old friend of mine. I'd worked with him on some other projects. He'd also looked after my son when my son was at Dartmouth College a few years ago. But I called Bob up one day, and I described the same things that I've described just now on the program. And I said, Bob, have you ever seen this kind of thing develop, take off, and sustain itself? And he said, no, I really haven't. And he's probably the leading research expert on this area that I know of. But what he said was that this is different in that it wasn't started by the professions. It was started by people who were in recovery themselves, and that's what seemed different. That was why he even wanted to help us write this up, do some research, describe it in more detail.
Well, you're on the board. Are professionals like yourself involved in any very specific way in guiding the development of the grassroots programs?
Well, there are some of us like this. We try to keep that hidden as much as possible. You know, it's Bureaucrats Anonymous or something. But we do have some people like me, but there are other people who are community members, people who have gone through the program themselves, and so on.
I would think the main use you would have would be in researching it and in describing it to other professionals rather than guiding its development.
Yeah, I can tell you that I haven't guided its development in terms of the content of the process at all. I think, Peter, you're right. One of the things that some people can bring, I think every board member can bring something different, but one of the things that I can bring is my knowledge of how the public system works, how to seed these things, how to give them support as they need it, and then get up, get going. And also, yeah, I think, you know, contacts with other colleagues, the ability to work with researchers and publish information that, you know, thousands and thousands of people can see.
Yeah. Now, you've got an actual working job in the mental health field right now. Am I right?
Well, yes, and I recently changed. I'm now working, as I said, in this 10-story office building in downtown Portland, Oregon. I'm now embedded in a physical healthcare managed care organization. One of the reasons I came to work here was that they actually recognized that they didn't know much about alcohol and drugs or mental health, and they wanted me to help come in and guide some of the reform efforts that are going on in Oregon. So, you know, Peter, as you and I talked, I'm not sure if this is going to work or not, but I'm willing to give it a try because at least the organization knows that they need some guidance, they need some expertise, they need some support in trying to truly make integrated physical health care happen. I could go into more detail about how the state of Oregon has sent all of the funding now to these physical health care plans, and they're supposed to then manage mental health and addictions and help people. You know, we know for sure that people with mental health challenges, major challenges, die 20 to 25 years before other Americans do. I actually did a study when I was the state mental health, and I was also the addictions director, in which I did a study in Oregon where I found out that people with both alcohol and drug and mental health problems, at least in Oregon, died at the average age of 43 years old. So there's some really serious health implications here that they've asked me to help step in and guide some programming.
Yeah, that's an incredible figure. I mean, one of the things that a number of us have been looking at is this shortened lifespan issue, some of which, or most of which, we've been attributing to the psychiatric drugs. But then when you get into dual diagnoses people, folks who are abusing drugs as well as having their own emotional problems, then you have both the psychiatric drugs and all the other drugs impairing health.
It's a pretty scary mix, pretty scary brew.
Yeah, that's very, very important. One of the things I'm hoping to see these mental health, these health organizations like the one you're working in do is begin to set up their own 12-step programs for people and peer training for people. And, you know, one of my great hopes is to see one of these organizations set up a training program for retired people, perhaps retired administrators and retired people from their own corporation, but, you know, just folks in general who could be trained to be counselors and therapists without any particular educational criteria, just that they're kind, empathic human beings who'd like to get a good solid year of counseling training, because I think if you pick people on the basis of their values and their maturity, they don't need a PhD or a master's. They just need maybe a year of good sound supervision in helping other human beings get their lives in order. Maybe you could be thinking about something like that for your program.
Yeah, exactly. Those are the kind of things that the state of Oregon, I mean, they're at least saying they want these kind of ideas to come forward. The organization that I'm working with now has a strong interest in whether peers, people, you know, who've been there and done that, could also be helpful. So I think there are a lot of areas here that we could begin to take some additional steps that will help people recover. That's really the whole bottom line here.
Yeah. Well, I wish you a lot of luck and a lot of good fortune there. I think, you know, I'm traveling around a lot lately, and I'm hearing interests more and more in these innovative programs. People are really getting the idea that these psychiatric drugs are doing more harm than good, that psychiatric diagnoses don't exactly empower people, and that, you know, it's really time to be looking at other models. Now, we've known for a century or two, going back to moral psychiatry and the havens that the Quakers set up a couple hundred years ago. We've known that non-medical, caring, supportive, wrap your heart around people programs really, really do work. And it's good to see someone like yourself, Bob, who's in a position to encourage these through the Foundation for Excellence for Mental Health, and that you've done it through being commissioner, and now maybe through this behavioral health program you're involved in. I want to really stay in close touch with you about all that. We've got about 10 minutes left. You want to talk some more about what you've learned over all these years of work in the field and where you see us going in the future?
Wow, that's a tall order. I've been so busy that sometimes I don't have time to sit back and reflect on these things. I think that probably the main learning that I've had in this business is that we're all people. You know, we don't need these hierarchical distinctions. Yeah, there's a place for boundaries, and I've been a family therapist, and I know all about that stuff. But ultimately, this is about people and relationships. Peter, when we were in Syracuse, I really appreciated one thing you said there. I appreciated a lot of things, but one of the things that's really stuck in my mind is you said, you know, we're not so much the molecules of the physical and the chemicals and all that, and we're not really just the dynamics. We're really made of relationships. And as I've hopefully matured into middle and then older adult status, I think there's so much to that. I know that when you try to accomplish things, at least in the public system, you can't do it without forming solid, trustful relationships with a lot of different levels of the people that are involved. So you need to be able to relate to legislators. You need to be able to work with families. You need to be able to relate with people who are struggling with these issues. And you've got to see them as human beings. Let me tell one quick story that I think illustrates this. One of the people that was closest to many of us in Oregon was a man named David Rompre. David passed away suddenly and tragically about 4 or 5 years ago. But David came up to me one day when I was in the state position, and he said to me, "Bob, why do you talk about these 5-bed facilities and these 16-bed residential programs?" And I said, "David, that's because they have that many beds." And he made this profound statement to me. He says, "Do you think we're lying around prostrate all the time?" And that really woke me up, and it said, wow, we've got to change our language too, which is another learning that I've been coming to. I don't like the term consumer anymore, because it implies that you have a person that's passively laying back, prostrate, if you will, with their mouth open, expecting to be delivered something, pills, food, whatever it is. So I think the other learning for me is that this isn't about professionals helping these poor patients. I don't even like the word patients anymore. I think it's really about people helping people, and that can take a lot of different forms.
Well, I'm with you 100% on that. Life is difficult for all human beings. Nobody gets through life easily. There aren't any biographies or autobiographies that read, and then he lived happily ever after without any difficulties and was a productive and fine human being. It's always more complicated than that for all of us. I mean,
I always like to misquote Mark Twain. He actually said one time, these were his words, "Heaven for society, hell for company." And I always turn that around and say that Mark Twain said he wanted to go to hell because that's where all the interesting people were going to end up.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're all here on Earth with us right now.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
All of us. It's
exactly.
All of us. Maybe presumably there'll always be some role for people who have done some extra training and extra thinking and extra educating, maybe. But if we're going to really have approaches in our society that prevent people from having ruinous lives because they break down when they're 17 or 18 years old, we use that model, it's going to have to be something that's so widely available that it's way beyond professional or just plain professional resources.
I think you're bringing up a really important point that we didn't touch on. I think professionals do have a place, but one of the things we need to do is train us differently than most of us were trained. And it's not that easy to change professional training curricula. But I think that's one of the challenges that we all have ahead of us here is to take what we've learned and change some of the things about professional training programs.
Yeah, that is a big goal of mine. nobody's yet invited me to run a training program at a psychology institute or a university, but I'm talking to a few people about changing their training programs or bringing in a different sense, because what it really takes to people is a personality that is kind and empathic and non-coercive and wants to really be there and provide people safety and maybe a little nudge and encouragement in the right directions. I mean, really basic stuff is the starting point. That actually is eradicated from people during most training. You have to I don't know if you felt the same way, but I had to de-indoctrinate a considerable part of my training, get over my training, in order to become somebody who's truly helpful to other human beings.
Yeah, I think I had to go through that process too. I had some really good mentors when I worked in the psychiatric hospital. There was a social worker by the name of Orville Shoemaker. And he talked about his goal in working with people was to turn them into fun people. And I thought, you know, that humanizes this a lot. Those are good ways to think about this work. We're not trying to take people's symptoms away necessarily. We're trying to help them have a good time in life to the degree they can.
Yeah, yeah. Well, nowadays it's very hard to find people like that in hospital settings. You know, back in the 50s when I was a volunteer at state mental hospitals, there were all kinds of interesting and unusual people doing therapy programs inside the hospital. But that's getting rarer and rarer now as the pharmaceutical model has come to dominate the hospitals. And we've just got to find alternative systems for developing that to really providing health care that at times is going to be fairly intensive and wraparound, that isn't a part of this drugging people system. I'm really hoping that folks will support your, you know, Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care and allow you to keep on offering services, offering the opportunity for the development of new programs around the country. You know, you and I have one thing in common that probably we can't handle in 2 minutes, which is we both share our lives with very powerful, amazing women.
Yeah.
I hope you say hello to my wife, your wife, and to Gina. But I don't know if you could make a brief comment about that as we wind down.
Well, Gina and I found each other kind of late in life. She's a little younger than I am, thank goodness. But we had been working together, and we found that we had so many things in common. But basically, we were trying to do the right thing. And when you are able to be in that kind of a relationship, it makes life much different. And there are a lot of ups and downs in this work that we've been doing. You know, some days the foundation work is really overwhelming, and I hope that I can be of support to her. And some days my work is really overwhelming, and I get discouraged, and Gina's there, and she understands because she's worked in the same field.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, Ginger and I are totally wrapped around each other in everything we do, from our national organization and everything but my practice, really. She's involved with my books and blogs and everything. And I'm looking forward, as I grow older, to her doing actually more of her own publications, because she's a marvelous writer as well. Bob, I think we're drawing to a close. I want to thank my good friend, Bob Nickel, N-I-K-K-E-L, for being out there in the world, for managing to work on this dangerous borderline between the institutions and society and community, a braver man than I, or perhaps more patient than I, in being able to do that. Bob, thanks very, very much for being on the program, and let's just stay in touch.
Thank you, Peter. It was a pleasure to be on here, and I look forward to being in touch more with you.
Thank you.